Welcome to the Italian Renaissance Podcast, where we discuss the culture and art of 15th and 16th century Italy. I'm your host, Lawrence Ginangeli. Andiamo avanti. Renaissance people, welcome back to the Italian Renaissance Podcast. I am so happy to be sitting here today with a friend and colleague, Julia Bender, to discuss with you at long last the relationship between Venice and Islam during the Renaissance. We have grazed this slightly when we talked about the Bellini workshop, looking at their characterizations of Alexandria in painting, and we've also discussed some of the influences on the Venetian Gothic style, if you remember our episode on Venetian palaces. Julia is a recent graduate from the University of Massachusetts Amherst with a master's degree in the history of art and architecture, where she specialized in medieval and Islamic art. Her most recent research includes representations of the game chess in medieval Islamic manuscripts, and most recently, the relationship between the Islamic world and Venice. She recently presented this relationship in a lecture to undergrads, which I was very lucky to attend. So, to get this conversation started, Julia, can you tell us about what exactly constitutes Islamic art in general, like the field, and how do you define the different factions, like the styles, the sultanates of Islamic art?
Well, thanks for that introduction, Lawrence. I'm very happy to be here. To jump right in, I'd say Islamic art is one of the hardest things to define in art history because it encompasses almost 1,500 years of history. The beginning of Islam was around 610 CE, and it also encompasses dozens of countries. So this can include art made by Muslims for religious or non-religious purposes, and it can also include art made in Islamic lands by people who may or may not be Muslim. And this is very different from what we might think of as Christian art, which we would associate much more with religious purposes. So an example would be a painting of a crucifixion. That would be an example of something that we might think of as Christian art. But Islamic art is very different because it does not have to be religious. And there's no really good reason why it's defined in this way. This is sort of just a way that the art historical canon came to be. And it definitely causes some problems when trying to study Islamic art. There's certainly a lot more information that you have to know in order to have a comprehensive understanding of Islamic art. Similarly confusing are the subsets of Islamic art, which can be divided in any number of ways, but they're often studied by sultanate or dynasty. Like today we'll be talking about the Mamluk Sultanate, who ruled on behalf of the Abbasids, and we'll also be talking about the Ottoman Empire, which was a huge conglomerate controlling parts of Europe, Asia, and Africa. So there's really, you can divide it in any number of ways. You can study by material, including metalwork, textile production, painting. You can divide it by the different subsets of Islam, Shia and Sunni, or you can divide it by country. So it's really kind of all over the place, but that's part of the fun of it.
Oh, that was a brilliant answer. Thank you so much, Julia. So you mentioned we're going to be talking about the Mamluks and the Ottomans. I want to start with the Mamluks, I suppose, because historically they come closer to Venice chronologically first, right? So what was the Mamluk relation to Venice? Who were they exactly? Where did they rule? What was their relationship to Venice? And is it fair to say that primary interactions between Venice and the Islamic world is due to mercantilism?
So the Mamluks ruled from about 1250 to 1520. So you're absolutely right that they are probably more in line with the original Ottoman settlement from the beginning. And they ruled much of Egypt and what is today Syria. So they started out as slave soldiers, actually, on behalf of another empire. And then eventually they ruled on behalf of the Abbasids. And they're probably best known for textile production, metalwork, and glassmaking. So by the 14th century, trade made up about 50% of the Venetian Republic's revenue, which is, of course, an enormous amount that their economy really heavily depended on. And much of this trade was conducted with the Mamluks, along with the Ottomans, as well as the Safavids. So part of the sort of myth of Venice is this idea of a highly exotic place, a real travel destination, and the objects coming in from the Mamluks really heighten this illusion. So owning an object that came from the East was a sign of wealth and status, and this is really how Venice got their reputation as the Porta Orientalis, which means gateway to the East, because they would bring in a ton of products from the Mamluks that they would then either keep for themselves or redistribute through the rest of Europe. And their economy, as I said, was heavily reliant on this trade for a lot of the wealth and success that the Venetians had during this time.
I love how you mentioned the myth of Venice there, because we talked so much about that and these merchants who arrive in Alexandria to save and then steal the body of St. Mark and bring it back. Can you maybe elaborate more of how the relationship to the Islamic world contributes to the development or the understanding of the myth of Venice?
So the myth of Venice really involves the idea that Venice is this sort of exotic and foreign travel destination, which of course can relate to its place on the Grand Tour, and it has this sense of mystery around it. And so through trade with the East, Venice kind of positioned itself in between Europe and Islamic lands. And this really gave it sort of a unique place within Europe. So Venice really became this sort of intermediary between the two. And of course, although it's geographically located in Europe, it had this real idea surrounding it of exoticism, foreignness, luxury goods, and that's all due to the goods that were being brought in from the Mamluks and the Ottomans.
Excellent. Thank you. So these goods, that's the next thing. If we're going to understand the mercantile relationship, we have to know, what are they exchanging? What's leaving Venice and going to the Islamic lands? What are they interested in from Venice? And what is Venice importing from their alliances with other mercantile powers from the Mamluks?
So trade not only brought into Venice more common things like spices, silk, wheat, and ash, but also highly luxurious artworks, which I know we'll talk about a little bit more. And something a lot of people are probably wondering is what it is that the Venetians supplied the Ottomans and the Mamluks, because they really primarily were the ones bringing in the goods and then distributing them to Europe. So the answer is really that the Venetians would bring certain goods, especially Parmesan cheese was a big one because the sultans really liked it. But the Venetians were really used more so for their geographic location because they provided, as I said, the Porta Orientalis or gateway to the East, so that different merchants from other parts of Italy would travel to Venice and then get the goods that were brought from the East and then distribute them through Italy and the rest of Europe.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Renaissance people, if you are enjoying the Italian Renaissance podcast, I have good news. We're now active on Patreon. You can show your love for the show by becoming a patron and get access to additional resources, information, and artworks. Better yet, those who join the Renaissance Master or Renaissance Patron tier will get access to at least one additional podcast episode each month. My goal is to ensure that the main podcast remains a free, accessible source for everyone. Become a patron today through the link in the show notes to support the continued production of new episodes and help build and maintain this community. The Italian Renaissance Shop is now also active on Etsy, linked in the show notes. Sport our logo or choose from a growing selection of Italian art-inspired designs. Discounts are offered to select Patreon tiers as well. Your support has my immortal gratitude. Now, enjoy the show. I love this idea of the sultans like salivating over Parmesan cheese, because that's something that hasn't changed in terms of just people loving Parmesan. And to consider the sultans making this a primary import from Venice, who they presumably got from like Alpine areas, is really, really delightful to me.
So if you want to read a little bit more about the Parmesan cheese situation, there is a text by Jesse J. Heisel called Interpreting the Veneto-Mamluk Gift Exchanges of 894. And he has this quote that reads, "Italian cheese has had, over the generations, become a popular, even indispensable food among the Egyptian elite. This, in other words, was dairy diplomacy and a tacit effort to stress the deep culinary, cultural, and economic connections between Venice and Cairo that had developed through generations of mercantile exchange." So Heisel also goes into some other interesting aspects of trade. And it's really interesting, I think, thinking about how there was this really deep cultural exchange, even beyond art history, that we don't often consider. And that includes anything from Parmesan cheese to things like medicinal texts that were also brought into Venice and then disseminated through the rest of Europe.
It's a little, I suppose, humorous for me to think about all of these necessary goods being brought in by Islamic traders that are going to influence the technological advances of Europe. Meanwhile, in Egypt, they want the cheese. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. So that's going to segue nicely into our next bit. Islamic innovation, how these relationships, mercantile relationships, spread actual technology, not just goods, that impact the overall development of technology in Europe and the maritime world.
Yeah, so one of the things that we can think about here is the way that the Venetians got to Islamic lands in the first place. So primarily, they would travel from Venice to Istanbul for the Ottomans, as well as Cairo or Alexandria for the Mamluks. And it's funny today thinking about how traveling across the Mediterranean doesn't seem like that big of a deal. You can just take a plane today, or you could take a motorboat. But of course, the Venetians did not have these luxuries, and the travel on boat could take weeks at a time sometimes. So one of the ways that the Venetians would travel is through a boat that was popularized, known as the cog ship. And of course, they don't have motors or engines. They were propelled by sails. And traveling on these boats, going to places like Alexandria, could take sometimes a month or longer. So these were really long, often perilous journeys, and the ships often had doctors, musicians, cooks, priests, etc. Anything the Venetians would need to stay comfortable on these travels. And something that I always find really interesting is studying the astrolabes that were used. And these are really complicated devices, super, super complex. And they're composed of a series of metal discs that kind of intertwine with one another. And they often had over 1,000 uses. One of the uses was to navigate the sea. So there are many examples surviving of this, and there's also charts kind of explaining how they can be used. It's super complicated and mathematics, so I am, of course, not the right person to explain how they're used, but there's a really beautiful example of one of them at the Met that people can look at. So it was inventions like this that really propelled the Venetians to expand their trade in the East. But then there were also a lot of inventions that were brought from Islamic lands back to Venice. I think the most interesting of which are medical texts, which has been a real interest of mine in the past 2 years studying in graduate school, because medical texts have a really long and complex history in Islam. Islamic lands had hospitals hundreds of years before the Europeans did and were developing medicines and all sorts of treatments for different ailments and writing down these things. And so one of these texts, the original one by Ibn Sina, was brought over to Venice and then translated into Latin and then disseminated throughout the rest of Europe. And that was really the beginning of a lot of medical studies in Europe that we honestly still use today. So there are a whole number of really fascinating exchanges, even beyond the art world, that can be studied between the intermingling of these two cultures.
That's wonderful. Do you recall by any chance what century that text is from?
So Ibn Sina lived in the 11th century, and he was really what we may consider the father of modern medicine. And he wrote down really fascinating, complicated beliefs on medicine and treatment of ailments. And so his text was copied over and over throughout time, by hand, of course, because this was before the printing press. And then eventually, when the Venetians and the Islamic lands started trading with one another, this was a major thing that was brought over into Europe.
So just to clarify, so the Cogship is a Venetian vessel, but the astrolabe itself is an Islamic invention used by the Venetians for navigation.
The astrolabe that the Venetians were using was a derivative of one that was used in Islamic lands, but the astrolabe actually goes back hundreds of years to the Hellenistic era. So it's something that was kind of invented and worked upon over and over again throughout time. The astrolabe was developed by the Islamic lands, and that's what Venetians were using, but the invention actually goes back to Hellenistic times.
Perfect. Thank you. So the Mamluks do not survive into the High Renaissance in Venice. They're absorbed by the Ottomans. And the Ottoman Empire is the longest reigning empire of all of the Islamic sultanates, correct? Very close, 600-something years. They begin around 1300, and they're dissolved in the early 20th century, right after World War I. So we're talking a very long reign for the Ottoman Empire. So in the 1400s, we have the Mamluks as major Mediterranean powers. And then after the fall of Constantinople in 1453, we've talked about that a lot, guys, the Ottomans under Mehmed II become even more prominent on the Mediterranean. They absorb the Mamluk Sultanate by 1517, taking full control of the Eastern Mediterranean. So, Julia, how does Venetian mercantile power change with the rise of the Ottoman Empire from around the 1430s and into the 16th century?
So the height of the Veneto-Ottoman relations was in the 15th and 16th centuries, and Constantinople really was the main trading hub for this. And at first, after the Ottomans absorbed the Mamluks, Venice greatly benefited from working so closely with them. Because, of course, as we've been talking about, they had access to all kinds of goods that they could purchase and then bring back to Venice and mark up and sell. And as we mentioned before, this was a huge component of their economy, and a lot of their success as a republic depended heavily on their trade with Islamic lands. While they were in Constantinople, it's worth noting that they would stay in places called fundaco, which were essentially an inn for traveling merchants. And then they would have certain men who were given the name Bailey, who were Venetian men elected to stay at trading colonies who could communicate between the Venetians and the different merchant centers like spice markets in Constantinople. So returning to the idea of how the Venetians benefited, of course, they benefited financially, but then you can start thinking about how big the Ottomans were as an empire compared to how small the Venetian Republic really was in the broader scheme of this time period. So the Venetians start to get a little worried that they're not going to be able to provide the Ottomans with the full trade service that they had been, because the Ottomans are looking at different options now. One of the places they would look is Padua, which was also a trading center and another place that the Ottomans could go. So now that the Ottomans are starting to recognize that they have other options for trade, the Venetians get very nervous, because if trade is not going through them, their economy would really collapse and it would be really bad for the Republic and their broader standing in the world. So one of the ways that the Venetians try to combat this is by offering the Ottoman Empire things like printed goods. And one of the things that they tried to print was the Quran. So the earliest printed version of the Quran, printed by the printing press, not by hand, was made in Venice. And so the first, or one of the earliest ones, is by a man named Paganino Paganini, which is a very Italian name, I have to say. And so he printed it, and then they tried selling it to the Ottomans, and it was kind of a disaster because they got every page wrong, and nobody in the Ottoman Empire really wanted a printed Quran, because why would you want that when you can have a nice handwritten one? So the Venetians were really starting to get desperate by the end of their relationship with the Ottomans as to what they could provide them that nowhere else could.
So a lot of people are interested in this sort of history of printing and what is Venice's role in that. Just briefly, and then I'll give it back to you, Julia, here. So the Gutenberg press is famously known as the first, the invention of printing, but printing did exist before that. The Gutenberg press out of Germany, it made it easier. So we can understand the sort of commercial elements of Venice becomes the hub of printing. Now, the most important printer in the city was one Aldus Manutius, or Aldo Manutio, depends on how you feel like pronouncing it. And he was the active printer during the age of who we were just speaking about, Titian and Giorgione. We're talking the turn of the century from the 14 to the 1500s. I know it's not necessarily Islamic, but could you give us a little information on what's going on with Aldus Manutius in the printing press in Venice?
Yeah, so Manutio was super revolutionary in the city, and he was born in Rome, but he lived in Venice, and he was a big part of the reason that Venice became what we consider still the print capital of the modern world. So by 1500, there were about 150 printing presses in the city of Venice, and they were at the forefront of publishing and disseminating really important information. Like, you can think of Marco Polo's travels. Part of the reason that Marco Polo is still very famous is because his travels were written down and then printed over and over again. And then you can also think, going back to what we were talking about before, of the medical texts being printed after being translated into Latin. So this period was, it's hard to compare it to something in the contemporary world, but you can think of it as being on par with something like the invention of the internet, just an explosion of dissemination of information. And it's a really fascinating period of history. But to get back into more specifics about printing and the history of printing in Venice, there was the invention of Roman scripts, the invention of italics in the octavo format. And there, Manutio specifically also invented the idea of the publisher's insignia, or their trademark. So his books were printed. They were also considered luxury objects at the time, owned by the very wealthy. So Manutio was very important in these relations between Venice and Islam, because he would take a lot of this information that was being brought in from Islamic lands, have it translated and have it published, and then disseminate it throughout the city. And it's also worth noting that a lot of the information that they got from Islamic lands had been taken originally from places further east, like China. So there's this huge, really interesting global fusion of ideas. For the first time, really, a lot of these ideas were being disseminated throughout the world.
Yes, and the more acute listeners will recall that the lovely Hipnerotomachia Polyphili, presumably by Francesco Colonna, it was printed by Aldus Manutius in 1499. And we also talked about Giorgione's, we talked about at length, Giorgione's references to poetry, which would have been further enabled by printed materials. And we discussed that Petrarch was being printed as well, also by Aldus Manutius, when Laura was conceived by Giorgione. He invented italics, what we use today. Is that true?
So one of the things that Manutio did was he studied ancient Roman texts and inscriptions, and he changed the Gothic script into a new style of lettering, which we really still use today. I always think it's so fascinating looking back at these really distant periods of history and seeing what has survived from them. And it's just really kind of surprising and funny that font is one of the things that remains really prominent in society today.
Now, in your introduction, I did, of course, say that you spent a lot of time studying medieval art as well, and presumably medieval manuscripts. So the Gothic minim, it's called, right? The upstroke of a pen. It's like the same on every letter. So if you're trying to read like a high medieval Gothic text, it just looks like a bunch of lines. And are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Do you struggle with that too? So to summarize that, reading high Gothic script sucks. And Aldus Manutius reinvented the way those letters are printed, and so that, well, revived them from Rome so that it was easier to read, because it was hard for them too. So we've taken a bit of a sidestep here, so I want to route us back to the Ottoman Mamluk discussion we're having. And when we're looking at Venetian painting and Venetian art, we see a lot of Islamic style penetrate and influence paintings in Venice. So what are these Islamic influences that manifest in Venetian Renaissance art?
So there are so many influences of art that came into Venice that it's hard to pinpoint one exactly. So I'll go through a few examples. I'd say, well, let me begin by saying that there was a man named Alejandro Magno who lived in the mid-16th century, and he's a really good example of what a lot of these merchants traveling in Islamic lands would do, which is he brought a sketchbook and then he drew what he saw. And then these ideas, these drawings were brought back to Venice and then studied by artists and architects. So in one of his visits to Cairo, he sketched, and very poorly, he wasn't a very good artist, but he sketched things that he saw, like ogee arches and mihrabs in the wall. And then these ideas, these new architectural elements that were at this time pretty foreign concepts to Venetian architecture, they would be brought into the city, and then they would be implemented in designs. So possibly the best building that this culminates in is the Doge's Palace, where you have examples of architectural elements like cresting, ogee arches, the diapering pattern, which is unfortunately named. There are so many examples of Islamic art and architecture being brought into Venice.
Yes, and hopefully listeners are familiar with this vocabulary from the Renaissance Palace episode. If not, go back and listen to it. And what about painting? You know, textiles are imported, but they appear in painting a lot. Can you comment on that for me, please?
Yeah, so textile arts is a relatively new field of study. And of course, I've had the pleasure of learning from one of the experts in the world about it, Walter Denny, who's our lovely professor here at UMass. And a lot of what we talked about is how carpets would be brought into Venice, not only in their physical form and used on the floor and wall coverings of Venetian homes, but they were often painted in luxurious paintings. So what comes to mind is a painting by a man named Alejandro Bonvicino. So in the early 16th century, there is a painting that he did called Portrait of a Man. I believe the man is unidentified. We don't know exactly who he is. But in this painting, you see things indicating his status. So he's looking directly at the viewer in a very austere and serious manner. There's a beautiful landscape behind him with rolling hills and kind of lavish scenery. He's holding a pen and paper, signifying his ability to read and write, of course, and his prominence in society. And then, interestingly, what we see in the foreground is an Oriental carpet that likely was a real carpet that existed that this man did own that was painted. And the carpet's not just there for its aesthetic value, it's there to signal that he's wealthy and is wealthy enough to collect objects like this and have them in his presence. So you can really think of these kind of objects as being signals of importance within society.
That's really interesting. So it's like this, the mercantile relationships between Venice and the Ottomans, more or less, but the Mamluks as well, produces a type of materiality that exists in Venetian culture that is Islamic. Carpets, textiles, metalwork, this sort of thing. And then those elements and the style of them get integrated into paintings to show wealth, so that Islamic style and Islamic materiality becomes a component of Venetian painting. Does that sound accurate to you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this relates perfectly to what we were talking about before, this idea of the myth of Venice, which, as we were saying, relates heavily to this sort of exoticism and lavishness. So these carpets were really big factors in disseminating that view of Venice throughout the rest of Europe.
And just an important side note to that, I imagine that this has to happen alongside the explosion of interest in oil painting in Venice, because I don't think you'd be able to really capture the materiality of the different textiles, the sheen, the glimmer, or the flatness without being able to work oil paints. And we discussed how Venice developed oil paint in relation to Netherlandish and Sicilian painting, etc., under the Bellini workshop. So this is all interacting with a much larger scheme that has to do with painting materials, mercantilism, printing, right? Exchanges of inventions and concepts and goods and cheese, right? Oh, very good.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And thinking about oil painting in this context, there are a number of paintings that we can look at. And if you look super closely, often with a magnifying glass, you can see the specific kind of knot used in the production of the carpet, which is just unbelievable to think about the amount of detail that went into painting these and capturing the reality, the essence of the carpet. There are also carpets that are, the pattern that they have is today named after the European painter that put them in their portraits. And of course, that gets a little problematic with why are we naming carpets that came out of the Middle East after European painters, but that's beside the fact. So one of the most common types of patterns would be the Holbein carpets. And an example of this, although not Italy, is a painting called the Somerset House Conference from the early 17th century, made in possibly Flanders. And this has a really clear depiction of a Holbein pattern, and it's just beautifully depicted. And again, this carpet is being used to heighten and emphasize the status and power of the men in the painting.
So in addition to the fun bit that Islamic patterns are being named based on European painters, Islamic art scholars can actually identify a possible origin based on the carpet patterns, correct? That you use carpet patterns as part of your art historical practice, right?
Yeah, so I just had the opportunity to take a class on Oriental carpets, actually, and it was really fascinating to learn about how this field is kind of emerging and how these carpets are being used to reveal broader things about the cultures in which they were made. So you're definitely right, pattern is a big factor in determining where these carpets were made, but it's also things like knot count and the dye used. And carpet weaving is far more intricate than I ever thought. So there are tons and tons of types of different knots that are used and different weaving techniques. And these techniques are really what can reveal exactly where the carpet was made. So for example, something called Z-spun yarn was made in the vast majority of places producing Oriental carpets. But in Egypt, for whatever reason, they used S-spun yarn. So when you look very closely at carpets, you can look at the spinning of the yarn that's used and determine whether or not it was made in Egypt or in somewhere else. And that's just one example of many different ways that you can determine where a carpet was made.
That is incredible. And I'm sure that takes a very skilled eye to do. So I think what is clear is that the only way to fully understand Venetian Renaissance art and history and culture is to have Islam on your mind, because they're sort of inseparable. They're connected in a sort of way, even though, of course, one is Christian and one is Islamic. There is a consistent exchange of styles and goods and inventions and objects, so that it's not really a side note. Islamic art and culture is an integral part of understanding the Venetian Renaissance. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaks to something much bigger in art history that I try to promote a lot, which is the idea that everything is really interconnected and we shouldn't view cultures, religions, societies in a vacuum, because it really takes away from the fact that there's this intermingling of cultures and ideas going on throughout history. So I think part of the reason that I find Venice and Islam really interesting is that this is the perfect culmination of how two cultures can influence one another. Of course, the Islamic civilizations probably influence Venice far more than Venice influenced them, but it shows a really interesting, very trackable history of ideas.
I like that you mentioned the kind of reduced impact of Venice, because that is the research that I did for Professor Walter Denny as well, researching the Venetian presence in the Ottoman courts. And that is actually going to be the subject of our next episode. Before we say goodbye to Julia, I do want to ask one more question, because we talked about carpets and we talked about patterns, and you always hear sort of the staple ways to identify Islamic art is, let's see, geometry, nature, and calligraphy. And famously, Islamic art does not include figures or portraits or people. But the reality is that is the furthest thing from the truth. Can you, just for the general education of our audience, remark on figural art in Islamic art, please?
Yeah, so the whole idea of figural art is very interesting to me because there are a lot of civilizations throughout history that we maybe think of as being aniconic, not having depictions of figures. So Islam is certainly one of them. Judaic art is another. But when you look closely at these cultures, there are absolutely figural imagery. It's sort of a myth that they don't have it. And I think it really comes down to a reduction of the artistic quality of these cultures. And it's really a shame because they produce absolutely beautiful art, many of which includes figures. But I have to say, too, we're really fixated on this idea that art needs to include figures to be beautiful. But if you look at any number of the objects that we talked about today, whether it's carpets, whether it's metalwork or paintings or glassmaking, a lot of these things don't include figural art, but that doesn't take away any of the artistic magnificence, really, that exists in them. They're absolutely beautiful. So really, my two-part answer to what you were just saying is that there absolutely is figural imagery, and you can find this across really all cultures. But it's also worth noting that a work of art doesn't need figural imagery in order to be perceived as beautiful.
That was an awesome answer. Thank you so much. And just like I briefly mentioned a moment ago, Sultan Mehmed II is going to hire Italian artists to come to his court in Istanbul and to paint his portrait. This is part of dispelling the myth of figural arts being a major no-no in Islamic lands. And on that note, I would like to thank you so much, Julia, for joining us today.
Thank you, Lawrence.
And we will see you all next time. Of course, almost every image, I will do my best, that we talked about today will be posted to the Instagram and the Facebook. So go give us a like and follow. Until next time, arrivederci.